This is episode 38 of the Far Middle Podcast. Nick Deolius with you. I hope you are enjoying your early mid-February and you're navigating through winter sufficiently. This is also the week where Thomas Alva Edison has a birthday. So happy birthday to Thomas Edison, an Ohio native of Milan, not sure how you pronounce it, Ohio. It's a small town. I actually had a chance to visit it last year, just off of Interstate 80. So if you're ever on I-80 and you're west of Cleveland, check out the birthplace if you've got an hour or so to kill of Thomas Edison. Just the epitome of small town America, a really cool little town. Big statue of Thomas Edison standing out there in the town square, just off the town square, and check it out if you can. We're going to dedicate episode 38 of the Far Middle to the greatest third baseman that you've never heard of and the greatest third baseman who never had a chance to play a day in the major leagues. So isn't history sort of fickle when it comes to timing and individuals and what might have been or what should have been? And the individual that I'm talking about, his name was Ray Dandridge. He played in the 1930s and in the 1940s in the Negro Leagues. He also spent some time in the Mexican League. And he was part of the famous million-dollar infield with the Newark Eagles in the Negro Leagues. And what's ironic about the million-dollar infield is, despite their name and probably being worth $1 million in terms of their ability, Ray Dandridge, he made less than $10,000 a year playing in the million-dollar infield. So sort of ironic, puts in perspective today's professional athletes' salaries versus what used to be back in the day, two very distinct contrasts. Ray Dandridge might have been the best third baseman in the field ever, the best fielding third baseman ever. So I'm not sure if it's Brooks Robinson or if it's Ray Dandridge, but he is certainly one of the two best ever. And for him, for Ray Dandridge, two errors in a season, that wasn't exceptional. That was pretty much the norm for his career. He averaged around two errors a season, a year, which is unbelievable. He also had the chance to become the first Black player in Major League Baseball. And the way that happened, Bill Veeck, who was with the Indians at the time, he wanted to add Ray Dandridge to the Indians organization before Jackie Robinson made his epic breakthrough. So we'll never know what would have become of that, because Ray Dandridge, he was very loyal. And at the time, he was playing in the Mexican League, and the team owner that he played for was the individual that stepped up and basically lured him away from the Negro Leagues because he offered him $10,000 a year in salary plus expenses. And Ray felt, you know, very obligated and loyal to the individual owner in the Mexican League to stay with him. So he had a shot, actually, to beat Jackie Robinson to become the first Black player in the major leagues. But because of his loyalty, he stayed with his team in Mexico. Interestingly, once Ray made it into sort of major league organizations later in his career, when he retired, he became a mentor later in his career to a guy by the name of Willie Mays in the Giants organization. And I think we all know what happened with Willie Mays and his career trajectory. So Ray Dandridge enjoys some of the credit and deserves some of the credit for everything that Willie Mays ultimately achieved. And Ray played from the ripe young age of 19 years old to the ripe old age of 41 years old. So think about that, from 19 to 41 years of age. He's a Baseball Hall of Famer. He is in the Hall of Fame, rightfully so. And he is our namesake for episode number 38. While Ray Dandridge was tearing up the Negro Leagues and the Mexican League in the 1930s, and I encourage you to read more about that, I think you'll really enjoy what you come across with his career. Across the globe at the same time, there was a sociopath tearing up humanity. And his name was Joseph Stalin, of course, one of the most brutal dictators in human history. And the story I'm about to tell you, people debate whether it's true and actually occurred. Some people think it's myth or urban legend, but I think it is very poignant, very telling. And the story revolves around Stalin plucking a live chicken in front of his followers to provide a lesson about governance. So the theory here is that this story expresses the thought that a dictator can do anything that he or she wants to the people, as long as the people think that the dictator is the source of their survival and that the people believe that they're dependent upon the state for their survival. And the author that sort of propagated this story about Stalin and the chicken and governance, his name was Aitmatov, and he was an anti-Stalinist, wrote prolifically in Russia through the decades during and after Stalin's demise and death. And the story goes something along the lines like this. So Stalin, gathers together his closest advisors and comrade-in-arms, and he tells them, He says, I understand you're wondering how I govern the people so that every last one of them thinks of me as a living God. Well, I'm going to teach you the right attitude towards the people, he says. And then Stalin orders a chicken to be brought in. And he plucks this chicken live in front of his followers down to the last feather. This chicken doesn't have a feather left on it. And all that's left is its red flesh and the comb on its head. So then Stalin says, now watch this. And what he does, he lets the chicken go. So the chicken could do whatever it wanted to do at that point, right? He had just had all of its feathers ripped off by this guy. Guy puts the chicken down. Does the chicken run away? Well, no, it's too hot in the sun for the chicken to go out there because he has no feathers to insulate him or her. And it's too cold, right, in the shade because, again, no feathers on the poor chicken. So all this poor bird can do is press itself up against Stalin, the one that basically ripped all of its feathers out. And it's just pressing itself up against his boots. So then Stalin tosses it a crumb. And of course, the chicken eats the crumb. And after that, everywhere Stalin went, the chicken would follow him. And otherwise, right, if the chicken didn't follow him, it was going to fall over from either exhaustion and or hunger. So after he displays this type of experiment and shows his followers what the chicken was doing, he turns to them and he says, that is how you govern our people. So Joseph Stalin, I think, was one of the originators of the whole of government approach, right, that we hear so much about today with different issues and policies and that the left often loves to embrace when it comes to heavy-handed policies. He knew how to keep power and to intimidate subjects, and whole of government was a very powerful tool to do so. And he wasn't afraid to use a controlled and subservient press, right, to propagandize his rhetoric and his image. That was almost a necessary requisite instrument to be able to apply the whole of government approach. Today, 2022, we in the Western world, we're experiencing much of the same playbook at work. Here, our governments, right, are using whole of government to shove climate change policies down our throats. And once again, the media is a useful column of government or an effective column of government to create the image and the cover to do so. So I came across something this week by accident. Once again, it's amazing how much you just stumble upon by accident. But I think it was quite unbelievable that illustrates this approach at play that I'm describing. This is a well-respected national paper from an EU country. So it's a country in Europe. This is basically their national paper. Great history, a great legacy of journalism tied to this paper. This is not a fly-by-night operation. You click on the homepage, and just underneath, as you typically see, right, with homepages for newspapers these days digitally, just underneath the paper's banner, right, banner name on the main menu, you've got all these major subcategories that you can click on under different categorization of news. So the first menu item is news, and then under news, right, now you've got your submenu. So the order of the submenu to me was very telling. First thing on the submenu, climate. Then you had COVID. Then third was nation, then world, then politics, then crime, then health. Last was education. Now think about that. Climate first, followed by COVID, nation, world, politics, crime, health, and education. This to me is eerily similar to the poll that we talked about a few episodes ago on how Americans place climate change around 15th on their list of worries. I think it was around 15th. But the media and the press acts like it's number one on the list. And this international paper is warranting with its ordering of that submenu that climate is more important, more urgent than COVID, than what's going on in the nation that this paper represents and reports on, than what's going on in the world that's more important than crime, health, and education. I don't think its readers believe that for 1 minute, yet the ruse is going to continue to go on. Which brings me to the next point, the next dot that I want to connect here on episode 38. If everybody in the know or in the elite club is so concerned about climate change, why is it that coastal real estate and real estate in big cities near water, coastal big cities, why is it there that the real estate markets continue to run up exponentially in price? You know, the real estate that in the know and elite are the buyers of. That can't be a good investment if it's going to be underwater by the end of 2022, right? So this topic brings together, I think, an interesting juxtaposition of two themes that we've been talking about on the Far Middle podcast. One is real estate as the ultimate, in many ways, market bubble that's created by government policy and Fed policy. plus the rise of the elite service thinking image bureaucratic class, right? These two themes of real estate bubble driven by policy, and then the second theme of the rise of this sort of elite service thinking image class. Now, both of these things come at the expense of the middle class, of the value creators, and of the taxpayer, because they all end up having to pay for that excess that these real estate bubbles and that the elite class and the thinking image class end up benefiting from. So in one day, this is one day's time, I saw the following transactions, real estate transactions, being celebrated in major media outlets. So the first one was the creator of a TV series. I won't name the TV series, but the TV series did have a set of famous twins on it. The creator was selling their Beverly Hills compound, and compound's the best way I can describe it, for $85 million. Now, this compound comes with a shark tank, and it's also, ironically or interestingly maybe, on the land where the infamous Manson murders occurred in the late 1960s. The structure, the house where the murders occurred, has been torn down, but this house was built in its place, but it sits on that land. Another real estate transaction, this one was from a social media and YouTube star that was doing real estate investing, bought a Malibu home on the beach for $40 million in California. A third transaction the same day that I saw, a billionaire hedge fund guy sold his Manhattan Central Park townhouse for $188 million, doubled his money from when he bought it 2 entire years ago. 2 years' time, he doubled his money, sold it for $188 million. Talk about a bubble. The fourth transaction, same day, all of these came across the wire. A dilapidated property in the hills of Montecito, California. Montecito is a beautiful town. Montecito, California, sold for $78 million. This was a dilapidated property and was owned by a professor and his wife. And then the fifth and final transaction that I saw that day, the estate of a deceased resort and media mogul, sold his Palm Springs compound out in California for $43 million. So if you go over these five transactions that I just ran through, you got a television series creator, a hedge fund manager or creator, a social media star, real estate speculator, a college professor, a media mogul. There is nothing wrong with these professions or those careers, but something is very wrong when these professions, which in the end rely on the tangible and the real and the foundational economy of making stuff to function, right? They can't function if that real part and underlying part of the economy isn't out there working every day. But they're the ones that are throwing hundreds of millions of dollars around in exclusive chunks of real estate. Instead of celebrating these transactions, what we should be doing, I think, is being sobered by them. In real estate and its insane valuations and the bubble that real estate is in brings me to the next dot to connect, how a range of asset classes and commodities are being driven up in price because of ill-advised government policy. Now, what type of policy? Energy policy, climate policy, work-labor policy, Fed policy, tax policy, and on it goes, all policies. Just consider the best performing sectors or markets in 2021. So we just wrapped 2021. If you looked at the best sectors or things you could be invested in 21, what were they? Number one, coffee, up 76% if you were invested in the commodity of coffee. Gasoline, number two, up 58%. Crude in 2021, up 55%, crude oil. S&P Energy, up 47%. Natural gas, up 47%. Cotton, up 44%, that's close. S&P Real Estate, up 42%, evidence of that real estate bubble I just spoke about. REITs, which is a form of real estate, up 41%. And then further down the list, copper's up 27%, corn, 22%, wheat, up 20%, cattle, up 20%, orange juice, up 19%, all of these in 2021. Basically, the market was led by these commodities in these sectors that were undergoing bubble-type valuations or inflationary pressures. So if you wonder why food prices and energy prices and home prices are up, the answer is because government is creating, via policy, supply chain bottlenecks, scarcity, higher costs, and inflation. So while the 1% made a killing in the 2021 market, the middle class got killed. And then if you want to move on to the thought about 2022, 2022's market performance might be a little bit different than 2021's. That's because the risk just keeps amping up more and more and flashing glaring red. The S&P 500 stock index is dangerously priced from a number of different metrics. If you look at price to sales, if you look at enterprise value to sales ratio, if you look at the Shiller-Cape index, if you look at price to book, if you look at enterprise value to EBITDA ratio, if you look at trailing 12 months PEs and then the near 12 months PEs, if you look price to free cash flow ratio, all of these metrics are scarily high right now. Like they're just in the extreme valuation end of the distribution curve. And I know that I've said it before on the Far Middle podcast, but I will say it again. Investor beware in 2022's shark-infested markets. It's getting very, very choppy out there. Now, as to commodities, I think they're going to continue to rise higher in market returns for 2022 because these ill-advised government policies, they are not going to be reversed anytime soon, and they're still going to end up making things worse before things get better. Now, here's what's most frightening of all. The equity markets like the S&P may actually be better investment options than the bond markets. In other words, bonds are even more outrageously priced than equities, and that should scare you. The equity risk premium spread between equity and bonds, it's above the average normal by about a standard deviation to historical averages. So even though stocks are unbelievably pricey and expensive, they still offer a better risk-adjusted return than bonds. And because bonds, right, they're even more outrageously expensive than stocks these days. Maybe that's not surprising if you think through it, considering there's a sovereign debt stack out there and even some corporate debt in Europe that offer negative yields. In other words, you end up paying to hold the bond. Crazy times indeed. And moving on to the next item, while markets are blinking red with these sky-high valuations, and we as a society, we are paying massive amounts of money to TV series creators and money managers and social media influencers and athletes and academics, our competitors are focusing their resources on STEM, on engineering, on science, and on tech. And if you think there's not a lot at stake with respect to this, please think again. Just think about and compare the United States and China. When you look at them and contrast them in the area or arena of STEM, China is minting double the PhDs that the US does every year. And guess what? 80% of Chinese PhDs are in STEM fields. And then when you look at the United States and China and you sort of compare the two when it comes to patents, China filed almost 69,000 patents in 2020. The United States filed about 59,000. China beat the United States on patent applications in 2019 too. So those are some troubling pairings of statistics when it comes to the stuff that truly innovates and disrupts society to the point where we get the step change improvements. And from a strategic advantage perspective or a strategic disadvantage, depending on your perspective, it matters tremendously in the arena of geopolitics when you're looking at the United States and China. Now, speaking of the United States and China, I do see some similarities between the behaviors of the two when it comes to optics. So let's talk about China first. Of course, we've got the Winter Olympics coming up in Beijing, and you're reading and hearing about all the different things that the Chinese Communist Party is going through, all the hoops they're jumping through to create the right visual, right, the right optics with respect to how people view and perceive what's going on with the country and the games. You've got industry being shut down to clear the air temporarily. You've got all kinds of different things going on with respect to the management of pandemic, management with respect to dissenting voices and the like. So it's a big sort of series of events in terms of kabuki theater to create an image that everybody knows and recognizes as a falsehood, but nevertheless, it continues on. And I'm sure they'll play the theater out flawlessly once the games start until the flame is extinguished at the end of the games. But then you compare that to what's going on in the United States and particularly in Los Angeles with the Super Bowl coming up next week. So when the Bengals are going to square off against the Rams in the Super Bowl, what do you see going on there? Well, the new stadium in Los Angeles, $5.5 billion, largely funded by taxpayer dollars, direct and indirect. The new arena, the new Colosseum, right, in terms of Roman times, circuses and bread, similar to what we're doing here. If you think about $5.5 billion and what we could have put that to or toward instead of a stadium to be used for however many times a year in football, you have a problem. The problem is where that stadium sits, it's in Englewood in Los Angeles, and it's close to LAX. But between LAX and the stadium, the roads, the routes, the underpasses are heavily populated with homeless. Of course, there's a homeless epidemic all across California. Specifically, Los Angeles has a massive problem. And the leaders within California and in Los Angeles were looking at the upcoming Super Bowl and saying, we got a problem. We got an optic problem, just like China has a problem when it comes to something like air quality for the Olympics. So what did our bureaucrats and political leaders do? They basically created a movement to relocate all the homeless, giving them some sort of short notice that this site needs to be vacated. They move them on to who knows where, a different location. Maybe they give them short-term vouchers for staying in hotels. Don't know exactly what they're doing or what's happening to those individuals that have nowhere to go. But the point is, get them out of here, move them out of the way before all the cameras show up and all the glitz hits with respect to the Super Bowl spectacle. And the ironic juxtaposition that you see when you sort of look at this on video or you see photos of this, you see all these homeless that are basically living along roadways and underneath highways, underneath the 405 and everything else. And then you've got these gigantic corporate logos from the NFL, from different soft drink companies, all of them, you know, touting the multi-billion dollar event that will be the Super Bowl. And just what an interesting contrast that on one hand, you've got all this excessive wealth and value creation occurring off of this event, but you still can't seem to get enough attention and enough focus to address a problem that should be, in the most powerful nation in the world, a very sort of fixable issue or something at least you can make a major impact on and impact it in a positive way. But nevertheless, optically, the show must go on. We move the homeless encampments. They won't bother the eyes of the elite and the people attending the Super Bowl. And then when the Super Bowl's over, I'm sure it'll be just a matter of time before the problem either returns to where it was originally in Englewood or, you know, ends up moving somewhere else because we've done nothing to address the underlying root causes of homelessness when it comes to the United States. Yes, I think, unfortunately, China and the United States share much more in common than we would like to admit these days, certainly more than I would like to admit, that's for sure. That about wraps up this episode number 38 of the Far Middle Podcast. You can check out, if you get a chance, the website nickdeolius.com. We've posted some interesting new ads to the website the last week or two. An article that we participated in with Forbes.com, it's linked there on the website. I think you'll enjoy reading that article. And also, we were a guest on the New York Stock Exchange podcast recently that is also linked to the website that you can give a listen to. Talks about a lot of the topics that are front and center with the Far Middle episodes of late, so I think you'll enjoy both. Twitter, at Nick Deolius. I continue to enjoy the feedback and everybody weighing in on the different posts and thoughts that we're putting out there. And Precipice, the left's campaign to destroy America, it hits shelves in late March coming up, and you can pre-order again online, Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and Indie Books. I encourage you to do so. I will talk to you in about a week for episode 39, and enjoy the rest of your week, everybody.